Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Grandstand cricket.
With a splendid innings for New Zealand, but they are all out for 370.
Another test is done and dusted. Now it's time for some post-match parlay with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins. Yeah! The Final Word with ABC Grandstand.
Welcome to The Final Word. Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon with you here in Brisbane at the conclusion of a wonderful test match. Australia beating Pakistan by 40 runs at the Gabba. But the fact that we even are here today, Jeff, and not having done this a couple of days ago, the test match stretching out to 5 days, we had no expectations, but it turned into an absolute classic.
Yeah, I mean, they pulled it out of nowhere. Literally the end of day two, you were saying this is done. You know, Pakistan had lost 8 wickets in that evening session. They were completely cooked. They were going to follow on and just get rolled. For it to go to day five, yeah, it's one of those ones where I feel like we'll get to say, you know, we were there. You know, I was there that day. I saw that innings. I mean, the third highest fourth innings total of all time Pakistan made.
It was really something, and getting to experience it with the Pakistani supporters down there next to the race yesterday. Like, there's some of the memories that I'll take with me for a very long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that, you know, that people turned out for that day five, you contrast that to day five against New Zealand last year when, you know, it was a dead match, but no one cared and no one showed up. And this year they had a few thousand people in. You know, they'd come down to see, you know, 2 wickets to go. It could have been over in 2 balls, literally, you know, starting that morning. And the fact that Pakistan battled it out for, you know, a good couple of hours and got within 40 runs of the win, and they had that pocket of wild support, you know, it was something that, it was a tenor that we don't normally have at Australian cricket grounds.
Yeah, for many reasons, it was our sport at its very best, and we'll bring that all to you today on The Final Word, alongside the second weekend of the Women's Big Bash League and a bit of a preview of the Blokes Big Bash League. Jeff, we're into the middle part of the summer where we're going to see 2020 cricket every single night.
So many bashes, and the size of them is notably large. You know, I mean, you just can't get away with a mid-sized bash at this stage. No small bashes, not interested in those. Don't bring them around. But if they're big, we're into it.
We're also into test match cricket principally, so we'll start there. Back on day one, Australia won the toss on Thursday. It feels like a really long time ago. It feels like so much has happened in our collective lives since then.
I don't even remember it. I mean, I feel like I wasn't born on Thursday. You know, yeah. My life has changed. I'm a different person.
We actually woke up on the Thursday to the cricket not being the main story. It was the MOU. It was the Australian Cricketers Association in the middle of a stoush with Cricket Australia, and that played out through the test match, and it kind of pervaded the coverage of the match in some respects, because it was such a notable story. And we're not a politics podcast per se, but it'd be remiss of us not to mention the fact that that was fairly messy.
Yeah, well, certainly the first couple of days that was the story, you know, because Pakistan were getting stomped on the field, as many people had predicted. Their batting wasn't supposed to hold up in Australian conditions, and so it did come down to this argument between, you know, the union and the governing body, and the clauses they were putting in for women cricketers that they weren't weren't putting in for men's cricketers and this ridiculous stuff about sort of behavioural expectations and that, you know, the women needed to be, you know, be nice and demure and sort of make sure the skirt was a credit card length below the knee and all that kind of garbage. And then, you know, getting chipped pretty solidly by the English Cricket Board, by Claire Connor over there, and the BBC was having a go. And James Sutherland sort of made out that the Cricket Australia was misrepresented, their position had been misrepresented, and that may be so, but it certainly wasn't a good look.
Yeah, it was. I think it was muddied up. By the time we got to the end of this media cycle or news cycle with the way this story evolved, it was scrappy. It was down to a statement war. There was a media release put out yesterday suggesting that negotiations had broken down, and the whole thing just reeked of something that should have stayed behind closed doors. But once it was aired in the public domain, it wasn't flattering for anyone involved, really.
But meantime, on the field, there's this sort of glorious example of Test cricket unfolding from a position that absolutely nobody expected. And it started to get, you know, the dream started to come alive sort of through day four. And then by the end of day four, it was a fully fledged golden vision of unicorns leaping over the city walls. And, you know, and then day five was just this ridiculous postscript to it. It almost didn't matter what happened on day five, did it?
No, it didn't. By the time we got to, if it was, I think I wrote, if it was 2 balls or 2 hours, it was still just a privilege that we were even getting to that stage, and Pakistan had truly earned that opportunity. But going back all the way to the start of the Test match, so this story's running around with the contractual arrangements and whatever else, and the cricket wasn't too crash hot. I'm going to be perfectly honest here. The day one wasn't an inspirational day of Test cricket. I think Australia did a fairly good job of laying a base, but Pakistan's bowlers were the fast bowler trio were the three who were meant to cause Australia problems, and they really didn't. I mean, the opening stand between Renshaw and Warner was quite convincing. Renshaw in particular looks like the sort of player who you can build around for a decade. He looks so solid at the crease.
Yeah, I didn't think the Pakistani bowlers performed badly. You know, you often see visiting sides come in and just really fall apart at the Gabba because they can't figure out sort of what lengths to bowl. They're getting carried away trying to be too attacking. They're sort of using the short ball attack, and they're getting picked off with the horizontal bat strokes and all the rest of it. I thought they actually bowled pretty well, the trio of left-armers.
Well, certainly Wahab and Muhammad Amir bowled really well. Yeah, Wahab when he was used, but
Rahat Ali wasn't too crash hot, and he didn't send down a lot of overs either. But, you know, it was reasonable batting conditions, and, you know, Wahab and Muhammad Amir had to sort of find a way to contain the Australians, and Renshaw in particular played well in just being patient and sort of waiting them out. And you know, he didn't batter slowly. He was outscoring David Warner while Warner was out there, you know, for the first 25 runs or so.
Yeah, but, I enjoyed that after the Adelaide experience that Warner was overtaken by Renshaw a couple of times, much to the amusement of those covering the game on radio and television.
And Warner sort of showed the preparedness to bat out of slow innings. You know, he was sort of going at a strike rate of 50 or so and wasn't feeling the need to, you know, to really get on top and dominate.
And there were two quick wickets. So Warner went for 32 leg before to Muhammad Amir and then Usman Khawaja. And this was an interesting dismissal in the context of the India tour, which they'll be selecting in the next month or so. Mm-hmm. Coming down the track and picking out short mid-wicket, it wasn't pretty.
It just looked like he hadn't quite switched on yet. And I think that can happen to a player. You know, it's very early in the innings. He sees a nice bit of flight that he likes. All right, I'll come down and meet that. And just played away from his body a bit and lifted it, you know, that which anybody can do, really. And as it happened, they had the short mid-wicket in and snared the catch. But so I think it really comes down to how does Khawaja bat against Yasir Shah in the next 4 innings that he's likely to play in Melbourne and Sydney? And if Yasir gets him a couple more times cheaply, then there might be tremors around whether Khawaja makes it onto the India tour or not, which seems ridiculous because he's playing so well. But he also seemed so just desolate in Sri Lanka. You know, I was on that tour watching him live, and he just seemed to have absolutely no idea how to face anybody on those spinning decks.
Yeah, seeing a member of the side, you'd want him going because you just feel like that's the right thing to do.
You want him to solve the problem.
Yeah, well, that's right. He 10:30 during the Test match. But with Renshaw going so well and looking so composed at the crease, and with the likelihood that Shaw Marsh will get a start in the first Test in India due to his experience in those conditions and quite strong record there, he may be the one to get squeezed. So there is some pressure on Khawaja at the moment, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, he may be, but it also may be a matter of, you know, Maddison being squeezed out down the order, Shaun Marsh coming in sort of in the middle order, and then maybe they go Hanscom at 6 and Marsh at 5 or something like that. I worry about Renshaw in India, just, you know, young left-hander Ravi Ashwin turning the ball away from him. Thank you very much. Like, I mean, that just could be 8 wickets for Ashwin.
Yeah, I fall into that category as well. I think that the broader benefit of Renshaw being ready for the first Test at the Gabba next year, whether that's him playing the rest of the Shield season, which can't hurt, and obviously playing you know, competitive Shield cricket all the way to the end. And if Queensland were to do well in that tournament, they'd be even playing in the Shield final and then going through to maybe getting himself some league cricket or even county cricket in England. That's not for nothing. I think that'd be a better investment almost than going to India and being under the pressure you're talking about.
Yeah, and maybe sort of coming home, you know, feeling desolate because he's failed in a few innings and been dropped. Although maybe they just have to take him, get him in the tour matches, get him in the spinning nets over there and just see if he can handle it. And if he looks like he might be able to, he might be able to use his height and use his long sort of long stride and get down the pitch and get over the top of the ball. And, you know, he may well be able to pull it off. I don't know.
Two men who certainly will be in India are Peter Hanscom and the captain, Steve Smith. They combined for 172 either side of the stumps on day one. So they came together in the second session. It was a wicketless third session. Smith was fortunate on 97. I shouldn't understate his innings, though. It was a very good innings. He batted very nicely.
He was fortunate on 50 odd as well. He got dropped.
He did
when he was 50 or so, and then he nicked off on 97, and no one appealed.
And no one appealed. Tree falling in the woods. Mohammad Amir actually got him out after having gone down like the proverbial about an hour before. So he misfielded a ball at fine leg, went down, and everyone was thinking the worst. It was, oh, is it going to be a knee reconstruction? Is his tour going to be over? Is this Simon Jones all over again? Will it destroy his career? All the rest, and he was back bowling within an hour. Which my conspiracy theory is that he just felt a little bit embarrassed about misfielding. He just didn't feel too good about letting the ball go past his leg. He thought, oh, gosh, I better quickly come up with a story. We've all been there, Jeff.
Somewhere or another, we've all been there.
I think as humans, we've all at one stage or another felt embarrassed about our behaviour and tried to apportion it to something else. And in this case, he quickly realised that he, you know, landed awkwardly on his knee and thought that maybe that may have been the reason that he misfielded.
Right, so it was a case of like, really? Like, do you think it was a huge performance? Like, I was gutted. I was like, oh my god, he's gone. He's gone for a year.
How could you not be? I mean,
he was howling.
His comeback's one of the stories of world cricket. Yeah. At the moment. He was bowling beautifully as well, and he continued to bowl well as he came back. His best spell of the entire match, indeed, was the one he bowled that night, an hour after his supposed knee injury.
But we had him. He was writhing around. We were all saying, oh, Simon Jones. He was never quite the same.
Absolutely.
And all the rest of it. He got stretchered off, and then just kind of wandered on an hour later. So I don't know. I mean, I think you can injure yourself and it can be intensely painful for a minute or so, and then you realize it wasn't that bad, and then maybe you feel silly, so you're like, maybe just stretch me off and then I'll just come back in half an hour when it's settled down.
Yeah, I think the giveaway was when he walked onto the stretcher for mine. But anyway, nicking off Smith on 97 and not being given, I think...
That can happen, though. Like when I crashed my early 80s Volvo a few years ago, I drove it onto the tow truck. Like, the entire front end was stoved in. Like, the engine had devoured itself. And that hardy old bugger of a thing was like, I'm just going to give it one more go. I turned the key and it fired up and started, and I drove it onto the truck. It was leaking, like, engine fluids everywhere, but, you know, gave it one last go. So maybe that's how we got on the stretcher.
If you're listening at home, do not follow Jeff Lemon's instructions on pretty much anything when it comes to personal safety, given he's broken every one of his limbs.
not all at the same time.
No,
separately.
Just
is that worse or better?
Ridiculous.
Would it be better if I'd done them all at once in some freak occurrence? No, I've ticked them off. 1, 2, 3, 4. Also a few ribs, a couple of toes. Split my head open. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah, you're a unique individual.
That's how you live.
So Smith nicks off, and why I wanted to mention that one more time is because Stuart Broad was so on point on Twitter after that occurred. Broad liking and favouriting and retweeting a whole bunch of tweets about how amusing the episode was. Of course, Stuart Broad, who smashed the ball to first slip at Leeds, wasn't it? First test of the 2013 Ashes series to Ashenagar, and copped endless grief for it and didn't walk. And the Stuart Broad is a ship bloke stuff and all the rest of it.
In defence of Stuart Broad, which I hate saying because I really find it hard to like Stuart Broad. Oh. He did edge it to the keeper and then it rebounded to first slip. Apparently, that, like, for a lot of people, that makes it worse. If you nick behind and don't walk, that's okay. But if you nick to first slip, it's just too outrageous that you would not walk. But it did actually go via a deflection. So was it as bad? I don't know. At the same time, you know, they didn't appeal. Like, you're not supposed to walk if no one appeals. If the bowling team doesn't think you're out, why are you supposed to leave? Oh, actually, guys, I hit that. You didn't notice, but I hit it. That's rubbish. Like, no one's suggesting that you should have to walk if they don't know that you're out.
It certainly became the talking point overnight. Certainly, all the coverage. It was like, it happened late on. It's like, oh, we got ourselves a story. So the international response was pretty interesting there.
We got a walker here. We got a walking story. Tell your story walking, about walking. Walker, Texas Ranger.
Certainly not. You know, you go back to the 2003 World Cup when Adam Gilchrist walked when he wasn't given to that bat pad decision. That would just not happen in modern cricket.
Right. I mean, absolutely. It's like the battle on Hoth. They've since brought down all of the walkers.
I don't even know where you're at now. But, so get some sleep, seriously. So next day, we get back. Day two. Let's get back to the cricket. Mm-hmm. Day two. And Hanscom resumes on 74. He struggled on night one to mm-hmm. the second new ball, wasn't it? He was struggling to that, and he grappled early, just like he had in Adelaide. But I find that almost the most endearing part of his character. It's that he does not look good early, but he seems to find a way through it, and he doesn't get himself out, and he puts himself into a good position to prosper later.
Yeah, he doesn't look perturbed by not looking good early, and I think that's the key, is that, you know, most batsmen struggle early in innings. You know, Ricky Ponting used to be a terrible starter sometimes. You know, anybody does, but some of them cover it up and pretend that they're not struggling. And you know, occasionally they do a sort of Khawaja from last summer where they just come out and cream them from ball one, but that's pretty unusual. So the fact that he's able to, you know, as a new player, he's certainly playing for his spot in his first couple of tests because people are calling for Nick Maddison's head because he hasn't made runs in three innings. So if Hanscom had been the same, you know, it would have been the same sort of chorus, but he's able to just keep calm, and I think that's his biggest asset, and that's why he might be able to do something in India. If you can get a big Smith-Hanscom partnership in some inning somewhere, we might have some chance of getting a total.
Yeah, winning a test match or making something over 200. It'll be a glorious day.
What a day. Holiday. Red letter day.
Peter Hanscom resumed on 64, and I think he where he showed his broader worth. Smith was loco on day two. He was swinging from his hip.
He was weird, wasn't he?
It was a weird way to resume his... Well, I mean, particularly on day two when they could... You get away with that when you're well over 100. When you come back on day two, don't get me wrong, no criticism there. But Hanscom had to play a different sort of role after Smith's inevitable somewhat demise, and that was batting with the lower order. And that's again something that batting five or six, Steve Waugh made an art form out of this. It's the idea that you can keep your head together when others around you maybe aren't. And that's certainly what happened with the Australia lower middle order, and that really now started with Nick Maddison at number six, which you shouldn't be talking about your number six as a lower middle order.
Great bowler though, sent down like a couple of great overs.
Well, Nick Maddison has traditionally been a number three or batted up at the top of the list for New South Wales as well.
But then he's sort of dropped into the middle order as well. He's opened a lot in T20 cricket, but then he's played through the middle order in first class. He's been one of those career floaters.
I guess my point is that at number six, he's a specialist, whereas we've had an all-rounder batting there for the last couple of years.
Yes.
But Maddison doesn't feel like a specialist batting there because of the way he was dismissed in that first innings, which was the most generous way of describing it is he was trying to let the ball go and at the last minute fended. But I think in reality, it was just a waft outside the off stump from a man who's rather nervous about trying to get bat on ball early in an innings. He was on one at the time, and that meant after two test innings, he only had one run to his name, and it was unflattering at best.
It's awkward, and then when you start bowling and conceding runs, and people are saying, well, he's actually now in net negative territory because he's conceded more than he's scored.
There must be quite a few of those, though, when you think about it. I think even like Glenn McGrath and Shane Warne are net negative because they would have conceded more runs than...
Than they made. Yeah, I suppose that's true. But what's a wicket worth? You know, is the wicket worth their career average? You know, is a wicket worth 25 runs?
Philosophical debate for a time. Just write an honest thesis out of that.
Yeah, is it worth the batting average of the batsman dismissed? Maybe. Is the wicket worth that many runs? But people are certainly asking about it. Nick Traynor on Twitter tweeted in exactly that question. Why Maddison over Patterson? A lot of people talking about Curtis Patterson as a good composed batsman who should be in down the order.
Patterson certainly has a case to be made. They are taking the same 12 to Melbourne, and I think they're backing Maddison in. They were urged by Trevor Holmes.
I think you have to, don't you? Like, you can't dump him after three innings.
No, you can't. And we'll talk more about his second innings as we go through. But
maybe shouldn't have picked him in the first place. I could make that argument. But having done it, you've got to at least give him some opportunity.
And they said they will. I mean, at that press conference a couple of Sundays ago when they named the 12 for Adelaide, they said, we are going to, you know, use the cliche, pick and stick here. So you can't expect they're going to revert back on that within two tests. It would be... And especially when two of the three have gone so well too. Like they've got some credit in the bank, and I think they'll be given the opportunity, especially having won both of those test matches, the old don't change your winning team philosophy, which is obviously a very big part of the way Australian sides have been selected over many generations. So
why wouldn't you pick and stick? It rhymes. I mean, people love stuff that rhymes. They're always like public safety things. They're like, if we can somehow get this to rhyme, or maybe alliteration, people are definitely going to do it. Don't be a fool. My helmet is cool. Remember that one in primary school when the bike helmets came in? Definitely left a lasting impression on me. I feel pretty cool every time I snap one on.
Who did look foolish? I love doing those segues. Foolish was Matthew Wade when he played a shot that gave the impression he was Joe Root at the top of the bounce, but the problem is he's not Joe Root. And he edged behind. And there's another player who's brought back into the side, mainly for his ability to make runs at test level, but struggled there. Before you knew it, it was Josh Hazlewood and Mitchell Stark in the two most prominent bowlers who can bat a wee bit, who also edged off to Shafiq at first slip. Amir picked up both of those. And it was 5 for 57 they had lost from Smith through to that stage. And at 8 for 380, a lot of the good work that had been done on day one, it looked like it had been undid, as it were, and they looked like they were going to be all out for less than 400. But then began what was a fascinating sidebar to this entire test match, Nathan Gary Lyon.
Nice, Gary. Two words that have summed up this test match. Yeah, beautiful, isn't it? New South Wales off-spinner becomes a cult hero in Queensland on a pitch known for pace bowlers and big hundreds. Somehow, the batting got it started. I think Matthew Wade's crap chat got it started as well.
I think there's plenty of Facebook smack around this after the Adelaide test with the nice Gary stuff. And I think that people were just up for this. For whatever reason, this hit a quarter. I mean, there's probably...
Every time Nathan Lyon bowls a ball, if you're not familiar with this, Matthew Wade says, "Nice, Gary," and the stump mics pick it up. Now, someone's edited all of these together into a compilation, and it goes for about an hour. So, I mean, that's how many times
I actually think it's
said
the compilation, it's one nice Gary
just over and over again
for an hour.
I want to see all of them. I want someone to get all of the
nice Garys. But it's the modern-day bowling Shane, you see, which obviously had such currency in the late 90s when Ian Healy and ultimately Adam Gilchrist both repeated that at will, as you would, because Shane Warne was a fine bowler. But
Areas warning
indeed. Which is still working. Still has great areas. Wonderful Instagram areas, Shane.
Check the comments on his Instagram feed. Just a lot of areas work around there. Hammer pineapple by tea, etc.
But they put on 49, Nathan Lyon and Jackson Burton. Mm-hmm. And Lyon picking up 29 of those. They were hooks, they were pulls, they were drives. There was wild roars in the crowd, and they managed to force Australia up to 429, and that was a far more commanding position. And of course, Jackson Bird, the man who missed out on the first Test squad, according to Rob Marsh, because of his batting. Remember that? What a marvellous time that was, by the way. About a month and a half ago, life was simpler then. It was before Donald Trump was elected president. Rod Marsh was the chairman of selectors. Yep. We had a middle order where Callum Ferguson was getting a start in, and Jackson Bird's batting determined whether he got a run.
Then at the Gabba, he plays one of the most perfect hook shots I've ever seen off his eyebrows for six. Never mind. Just over backward square. Swivel, clunk. It actually looked like a batsman's shot. Whereas Nathan Lyon's ones were those sort of crouchy, weird, like get a bit low and then kind of foot the thing over your shoulder. But he was still swatting them away for four.
Yeah, I felt sorry for Wahab and Muhammad Amir, who took four wickets apiece and who were both really quite outstanding on that second morning, and that much of their good work, as I said before, was effectively undone. And that did change the tenor of the day. And it was
not
almost
just the
inevitable
runs, but also the time, because it meant that Pakistan would have been out there getting set in daylight and then have been able to tackle the evening session, whereas really, as it was, they went straight into the night.
That's right, because they took an early dinner break, if memory serves, or it was around that time that Pakistan had to come out, and they never really stood a chance once they were batting under lights with the pink ball. Australia's fast bowlers, Josh Hazlewood, Mitchell Stark and Jackson Bird, took three wickets apiece, and it was an absolute demolition job, really. At one stage, they were 8 for 67, pretty much all of their high-profile bats were nicked off, from the start, really. Yeah. Babar, the prodigy, he didn't last long. Hazlewood picked up him. Yunus was out first ball. Misbah was taken by Jackson Bird, only on a couple. Asad Shafiq, who did so well later on, he edged to Usman Khawaja in the slips. A really good catch, actually.
Yeah, he took a few good catches, Khawaja. He's suddenly come good on that front.
Yeah, Sami Aslam, who's a real talent. His 100-ball resistance ended when he was on 22. But I think
he looked great. He was a highlight of the first innings for me, with carnage all around him. What is he, 21 years old? I think
he's 20, yeah. Quality player.
And he was, sixth or seventh wicket to fall? He saw all the rest of the top order go, and he just kept leaving, and that was the difference, is that everybody else played outside, well outside their off stump. Yunus Khan walked outside his off stump as if he was going to the shops, and then nicked the ball that he met along the way. They were all fishing outside off, except for Sami Aslam, who was prepared to leave the ball.
Yeah, and after a couple of the bowlers were taken as well, it's 8 for 67, and there was some time to go. They could have easily been rock and rolled on night two, and it would have been a different test match entirely. But Sarfraz Ahmed, who's a player who's made runs against Australia before, of course, in the UAE a couple of years ago.
Love him.
He combined with mostly Muhammad Amir, who made 21 but batted for about 2 hours, while Sarfraz accumulated for an unbeaten 59. And, I mean, it didn't changed the game dramatically, but getting up to 142 wasn't for nothing as far as just making this, at least forcing Australia to have to make a decision about the follow-on.
Well, also, I think...
Because they definitely would have made the follow-on had they bowled them out.
Yeah, had they bowled them out in that evening session, they wouldn't have. It just wouldn't have been possible to not do it.
Exactly.
The fact that it pushed it out to sort of 55 overs or whatever it was, batted for a while, and that the next day, and the Australians could see that it was damn hot and they were going to have to come out and start. They'd have to start their bowling innings in that heat. And I think it just gave Pakistan a little bit of heart as well, because Safra's really got on top for a while.
Like sure did, yeah.
You know, he actually looked completely in control. Amir looked unruffled. And Safra's is so... He's irresistible. You know, he's got such a kind of bubbly personality, and he's energetic, and he's playing ridiculous shots, and he's, you know, he just cracks me up. He's a Pakistani Mick Malloy in the face. Like, he's got a startling resemblance to our now cricket radio colleague, part of the cricket commentary fraternity, Mick Malloy. You know, he just gave them a bit of energy back, so that when they came out and bowled, you know, and they bowled with some purpose. Australia was batting for a declaration, but Pakistan, I thought, actually did reasonably well to keep them to about five and over when the Aussies were really looking to tee off. I mean, David Warner came out going T20, you know, and then hold out for 12.
Well, they did force issues. I mean, the Australian bowlers who finished off with three wickets apiece, as mentioned before, I mean, they would have thought, you know, put the heels up and chill out. And they were basically able to do that for a session and a bit. I think they batted for 39 and a half overs or whatever it was before Smith called them in. I won't go into too much depth about the declaration batting. I'm not a huge fan of that. But needless to say, David Warner didn't last long. Matt Renshaw nicked off to an absolute screamer, and there was a couple of half centuries in there too for Khawaja and Smith, although two half centuries with a little pressure, as you can imagine, in Test cricket. Nick Maddison was also dismissed cheaply for four after coming out and doing what they've all said was the team thing. And I have a bit of sympathy for this. He did come out and try and hit every ball he faced, which is what his job was to do. The easy thing would have been to have came out and batted conservatively, knowing the declaration was coming. So even though he's gone out cheaply again, I think we can give him a leave pass on this one.
It's interesting, isn't it, that so Adam Voges last summer, I remember him saying that he took the opposite approach with Mitchell Marsh when they were near a declaration.
He told
Mitchell Marsh to get down the other end and not face a ball, because he didn't want him to get out and
have
the pressure on him.
Where were you? I think maybe Hobart, Melbourne, possibly one of those. Either way, yeah, I agree. I remember it well. He said very clearly that he didn't want his state teammate, who he was very close to be exposed to selection speculation, and didn't want him to...
because he'd got out for two trying to have a slog.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's exactly what happened with Maddison. It was very near the break as well, so he would have only had 10-20 minutes to bat.
Yeah, I think Wade faced about five balls. So we were inside the last 10 minutes when Maddison was dismissed. So he could have batted, you know, just knocked the ball around for 10 minutes and probably no one would have noticed. But so to be fair to Maddison, in the context of a pretty ordinary first two test matches, I feel for him there.
But maybe he was just so obviously trying to do the team thing and make it seem that he was doing the team thing that it actually worked against him. Because maybe the sensible batting approach would have been get a single, get Pete Hanscom on strike. He was on 37 off 20 balls. Whatever it was, give him the strike. He's a fine attacking T20 player as well, and he'd been out there for a while. You know, give him the strike and let him take responsibility for upping the ante.
Ultimately, Australia left Pakistan 490 for the most unlikeliest of victories.
Cheeky 490.
It would have been the biggest chase in the history of Test cricket.
We hear that by a long margin.
We hear that a fair bit. 418 is the most ever, and you know that stat. You know, they'll need to chase more than anyone ever has before. But it still copped some criticism after the fact, whether Steve Smith needed to declare when he did, whether he could have batted for longer, and likewise, whether they should have even enforced the follow-on.
Yeah,
so
there's a lot of Monday
morning quarterbacking going on here.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, they should have, you know, when they had him down, they should have enforced the follow-on. Who's to say if they'd enforced the follow-on, a similar sort of innings wouldn't have occurred. Pakistan wouldn't have set Australia a couple of hundred on the last day, and Australia would have been cooked because they'd spent 2 days in the field.
Yeah, and it's not like me to jump to the defence for these decisions straight away, but I think there is some evidence to look at here. First of all, day three was extremely hot, and setting your bowl straight out after 52 overs in would have been 35 or so degrees for the hot part of the day. That has an effect. The fact that we've got two test matches back-to-back in Melbourne and Sydney coming up in less than a week, the fact that there was so much time left in the game, they bowled out Pakistan early on day three.
The fact that
a declaration, I mean, 490. I mean, a team has never lost after setting aside 490. So to say that it was conservative, of course he could have taken more time out of the game, but in modern cricket, earning that extra day off, earning that fifth day to relax and not have to worry about, you know, getting ready. The way they get ready, they don't go to the pub till 1 in the morning and, you know, dust themselves off and play some cricket like it was in the good old days. This is an elaborate process to get yourself up to bowling. each day, particularly as a quick. And I think that trying to provide themselves with one extra day was perfectly worthwhile. And trying to bowl at night, the evidence we've seen in day-night test cricket with the pink ball is that bowling after dark does provide a significant advantage. Now, that sample didn't continue this time. It wasn't as easy the second time around, far from it. And we'll go into depth as to why that was. But based on the available evidence for Steve Smith, I think he's been stitched up a bit here.
Well, absolutely. And particularly that, you know, as we said, they bozoed Pakistan, you know, 8 for 60 on that second night. Why wouldn't you say, let's have a crack at them on the third night, hopefully do the same thing, you know, either wrap it up that evening or early on the fourth day and be done with it? And they really could have. I mean, they could have effectively, like, won by hundreds and hundreds at that point. And the fact is that they were faced with one of the greatest rear guard batting performances in cricket history. That's not for nothing.
No, absolutely.
That can happen. It will very rarely happen, but sometimes a team just produces a performance that is outstanding. Now, that doesn't mean that the other team didn't play well.
The most significant thing that happened on night three, apart from losing a couple of wickets, was the ridiculous crowd behaviour in front of us there what amounted to Bay 13. Like the old days, really, there were the beer snakes, there was the sculling out of people's shoes. Did you know that was the thing, the shoey thing? I mean, I gather it's a...
Oh, absolutely. There's one of the pubs we visited in Brisbane, they were serving drinks out of gumboots, like children's gumboots at the bar. You could buy an official shoe.
I don't follow motorsport, but I think it has to do with one of our motorsport stars.
It's become popular. Who is it? Yeah, it's Daniel Ricciardo.
Likes
to do a shoey, but the shoey definitely predates Daniel Ricciardo. So
Okay. If
you're not familiar with the shoey, it's a cultural phenomenon in which generally a young male demonstrates his primacy for the herd by tipping an alcoholic beverage into an item of footwear and then drinking it out of that item. I think it's supposed to display a sort of disregard for hygiene, a general sort of toughness of demeanour, a lack of fear of social norms. And in doing so, can attribute alpha dog status to the drinker of the shoe.
Well, when the police gathered around, were effectively joining in. Well, not joining in, shoeing as such. But
that would have been great. That would have been the most Australian moment ever. Like, six cops all doing a shoeing.
But they were not getting involved. They certainly weren't kicking anyone out until they started the beer snake.
Oh, kind of
do
a
not,
snake.
Do not start the beer snake. But anyway, alas.
You can't stop the snake.
You can't stop the snake. You can't build the snake and it will grow, as the song goes. So, as that old philosopher, that old KGL philosopher, that bloke at Cardiff sang last year. Anyway, so the long and the short was that they came back with 8 wickets in hand, but we didn't expect for the life of us we'd have a day five. 8 wickets was like, yeah, there might be a bit of weather about, as they say, a few golf ball-sized hail bits and bobs.
As someone once said, how did they measure hailstones before they had golf balls? You know, they're like, oh, it's definitely the size of something indeterminate.
But it did hail a wee bit, and we did have a massive thunderstorm in Brisbane. But either side,
invented golf balls was like, oh my god, this is awesome. It's just the size of big hail.
Especially when in Queensland and the test match is going on. It's
absolutely
always golf ball size at the Woolloongabba.
And the newsreaders can roll out that that tape that they always like to do. Our power lines were brought down, trees were uprooted, and cars were damaged.
With golf ball-sized hail. There you go. You should be in the news, Jeff. Now, so they came back. So Azhar Ali was batting with Yunus Khan. He faced 19 balls the previous night. Useless Khan. I shouldn't say that. I took a set against him during the summer because I thought, why is he still going around? I think he should have retired.
During the English summer?
Yeah, during the English summer. I took a bit of a set against him. Then he made 200.
And then he made 200.
Yeah.
So
I was in a bit of that mood again as day four commenced, and he made 65. I'm not going to say it was the most elegant 65. I'm not going to say it was the most well-controlled 65, hooking at will and just defied logic. But, hey, he was there. He made the runs. What can you say? Even though he got out reverse sweeping, he's reverse swept since the start of his career, even before it was in fashion. So I don't think we can begrudge him too much.
No, I mean, the hook shots were the really weird ones. And I don't think he connected one of them.
He top-edged one over leg slip
for a single. But when he was playing the fuller stuff, he actually started to look quite good. Now, when he came out, it was late on the third night, he looked absolutely awful. Josh Hazlewood was giving him a working over.
Lucky not to get a pair, wasn't he? He got beaten several times.
He's never made a pair in Test cricket. And he was, the ball was ripping past the inside edge over the stumps. So Hazlewood had 3 full overs at him. And I think he was batting with Asad Shafiq? I was thinking, like, why doesn't...
Azhar Ali.
Sorry, yeah, Azhar Ali at the time. I was thinking, why doesn't he kind of, he needs to shepherd him. He needs to keep him away from Hazelwood because he's the most dangerous bowler for Yunus at this point. And they didn't manage to do that. Yunus had to face a good three overs from Hazelwood, and every ball I expected his wicket.
So we went through this process on day four where each time a wicket fell, we're like, oh, well, that'll be the one.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the thing that gets us to a day five not occurring. So, I mean, Azhar Ali batted really well for 71. He barely made a run to begin with. He took 51 minutes to get off the mark, to resume his innings on day four, but finally was out for 71. And Misbah came and went fairly quickly. It was 4 for 165. And when Yunus fell to that reverse, sorry, I'm losing my words here, 5 for 173 when Yunus finally was out reverse sweeping. And that's when we booked a studio here.
Yeah,
We literally booked this studio for 24 hours ago for this exact time slot, thinking, well, there's no way. Not with the bowlers ahead of them, not with, you know, Sarfraz, not with an extended final session, not batting under lights for at least 2 hours, maybe three, and with an extra half hour available to Steve Smith after that rain delay and all the rest. We were just convinced that was what we were doing.
Oh, there was no way it could have been any different. You know, you were down to the wicketkeeper and the last recognised batsman who'd been pretty poor in the first innings and had a pretty miserable tour of New Zealand before that. You know, Asad Shafiq was off a pretty shocking run coming into this innings.
Sure, yeah, and he didn't look particularly convincing in the first dig either. So Asad Shafiq first joined with Sarfraz for 47, and that was after Smith dropped Sarfraz. So it still felt, even when Sarfraz went hour and a half to go, like Australia will surely finish this off.
Mm-hmm.
Then Mohammad Amir came out and made 90. Well, they put on 92.
The knee was looking good in that innings.
Yeah,
wasn't
he was looking particularly good. As was his slap over mid wicket. His cover drives were delightful.
Everything outside the off stump. He basically just sort of guarded off stump. He left a bit. You know, he got out of the way of short balls to some degree. But if there was a bit of width for him, he just carved over gully point and got away with it again.
Yeah, and a few more controlled strokes on the carpet as well, and really exercised Mitchell Starc, who wanted to kill him at the time, which I quite enjoyed as well.
Yeah, that was nice. There was a little, you know, that real kind of, you know, Mitchell Starc giving the theatrical sort of finger to the ear. Like, what was that? What was that, mate? What did you say?
What did you say?
Come over here and say that, you know.
But it went on until Amir was finally dismissed on 48. So he missed out on his first career half century. Which
but it was his top score.
It was his top score, not for nothing. I'm sure we'll see plenty more of him with the bat in this series. Then Wahab Riaz, who, you know, not known for it, let's be honest. Wahab Riaz is not known for much more than giving it a wallop. And he did. He swung at everything. He either had these really deliberate leaves, which I really enjoyed. You know, the quite pronounced leave when he was like Justin Langer, way over the top of the wall. Or he was trying to put him on the moon. And like both occurred. Versions of both occurred at different stages through that cameo. He put on 66, but in between times, Asad was made his way to 100. It was an incredible last over. They did take the extra half an hour. Umpire Gould forced them to do so. Australian management weren't thrilled about that, as it turned out.
Yeah, which, as far as I understand it, isn't within the rules. You're only supposed to extend if one of the captains requests it.
Isn't it? It feels as though there was definitely a discussion had earlier on, according to Steve Smith, in the session, but whether at that exact juncture they said, are we going to go or not? Gould was very determined to go, and so they went. So it seems
obviously
like it was,
just wanted to come and get on the gas.
Yeah, just wanted to have not have a day five either. I can respect that. At least he's being honest and true to himself. His own what they call it's his own truth.
Sure, but like a 1 p.m. start, you know, like it's not that bad.
Not that prohibitive, is it? It's a real drinking man's starting time, isn't it? Like, you know, those guys who want to go out and get full, like umpire Gould, if that's the case.
Umpire Gould just doing a shooey in the stands, you know,
maybe even before
just jumping in the pool.
It's a lunchtime. It's a lunchtime soaker before he has to go out and officiate the test match. It's entirely plausible at 1 o'clock starting time.
Umpire Ian Pooled.
Yes. Well, we haven't even talked about the pool either. Blimey. How have we got this far into the podcast not talked about the pool? Let's just do that now.
That was fantastic. I'm all for it. Swimming pools are test cricket. Let's make it happen.
It felt weird when you saw it when you first got there, but I think as the test match went on, it definitely added something. It was definitely part of that Nathan Lyon, Gary Lyon, Gazza stuff. That I think the pool brought that out even more. And day-night cricket definitely suits Brisbane.
Yeah, and it suits looseness.
That was effectively what I was saying. It suits Brisbane.
Right.
They love to get full up here.
But, I mean, you know, it's just such a good crowd the first couple of days as well. The Thursday was huge, the Friday was big, and the Saturday was decent.
Broke records. It was the highest non-Ashes test crowd they've ever had here.
Yeah, and it felt like it, you know, walking in, as opposed to last year, where they closed off half the grandstand and all the upper tiers were closed because they didn't want to have to hire security guards to man empty stands. This year, you know, all those upper decks were pretty full before play on day one. It was exciting. There was actually atmosphere. It remains to be seen whether it will still be that way in 10 years' time if they keep doing day-night tests. But at least for this first one, it was It was big.
No, I did enjoy that. And I guess the crowd who was left there for Assad's 100, it was just an extraordinary moment in the last over of the day. The first ball of that over, slaying through a backward point, wasn't it? Or more just ahead of point, actually. And, and coming back for that third run, which at the time was just a glorious moment. And I think we're all, and you were down there next to the Pakistan race. And, and they couldn't have been more elated. But
They were just delighted. You know, Misbah was beaming, sort of standing outside the rooms. You know, I shot a little video down there of their reaction, and they were just so happy for him, you know, that they'd got something meaningful out of this, out of what was a really parlous situation.
And they also and they also had to question after the fact, regrettably, whether he should have taken the third run.
Yeah.
Because it did expose Wahab to facing five balls in the last over when they were almost all the way through to stumps.
And it sort of mucks around Wahab's approach, because before that he was breezy, you know, he was carefree, he was confident. In the last over, he was like, oh, I've got to be careful here, I've got to sort of cover up. And he just sort of tried to, you know, push a Jackson Bird delivery away, maybe find a single
or something. It's the first time he prodded at anything. Yeah. He was full-blooded strikes where he was letting the ball go. That's the first time he actually saw that type of defence deployed, and yeah, as you said, he nicked behind, and that exposed Yasir Shah, who, sure enough, first ball clipped through mid-wicket like he was Mark Waugh, and just to end the madness of the day, really, wasn't it? It was a very special evening. It ended up going for 3 hours, so the scheduled close of play at Brisbane was 8 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
We went to 10:05, so
absolutely
that proves to me my point from 2 weeks ago on the podcast, that you can play later in these day-night tests and not focus on, because I think that if you get a full session with the lights beaming and it actually dark outside, notwithstanding the artificial light, I think that brings something else to it. I think that, you know, even more than what we have when it's just 45 minutes to an hour.
If those are the playing conditions and everyone's exposed to the same conditions, that's fine. I think it was really unfair on Pakistan. I mean, they had to bat three nights under lights. Australia had to bat one. But that last one, you know, that night four session, there was 42 overs in that session.
Which made the achievement all the more considerable. So when
they
came back
183 runs in the session.
Well, yeah. How many sessions have you ever seen worth
that?
Well, and it created this situation where we arrived on day five with 108 to get, and, you know, you're watching all the old tapes of Alan Border and Jeff Thompson in Melbourne against England in 1981. You got the vision of Edgbaston in 2005.
They needed 107 with 2 wickets to go on the last day.
108 and 2 wickets in Brisbane. So it was this lovely parallel. And, you know, we all love this. The scrap on the last day, the Tim May and Craig McDermott partnership in Adelaide in January of 1993. Yep. I mean, these things, we can identify with it because we can remember it.
Yeah, and when you... you know, I think Dirk Nanna said this in commentary, when you give a tailender something to play for, you know, suddenly they seem to get a lot better at batting. You know, they're less likely to go out there and be loose and just try to wallop everything over the fence, because it's like, well, you guys could actually win a test match with the bat.
Very quickly, they became the 20th side ever make 400 in the fourth innings. There was strike management, there were edges, there were uppercuts, there were plays and misses, there was roars and chanting as they passed the 404 that Australia made in Leeds in 1948, famously, of course, with a chase three down. They passed the 417 made in the centenary test in the fourth innings. They passed the 418 the West Indies made to defeat Australia in 2003. That's significant because that's the biggest ever successful chase. And as they stormed into the top five, we thought they were there. We thought this was happening. We started readying ourselves to run downstairs just as Asad Shafiq finally fell after one of the truly great fourth innings hundreds.
I was pretty sure, and I think you'll back me up on this, yesterday I was consistently saying they're still going to lose. They're going to lose closely.
You moved over, though. There was a time
I was hoping that it would happen.
You moved over to think they were, you know, I think we both did. I was very conservative too until I got within 50, and I thought, with 2 wickets in hand, they're a real show.
I just always felt all day, I thought at some point, there are so many deliveries required to be bowled to get these runs, that at some point a chance will come. And as soon as the chance comes, the second will follow, because there's been so much tension and drama, and Rahat Ali at 11 won't be able to offer much.
Well, but the chance did come, and Matthew Wade did drop it. So it's not for nothing that it was the drop catch. And
there was also the LB that was overturned.
And he missed a stumping offline earlier in the test match, which I feel obliged to mention as well. There was an LBW overturned off Yasir, albeit a poor decision from umpire Illingworth. It was going considerably miles over the stump.
Yeah, but imagine if they'd had no reviews left. You know, that would have been this great injustice, this great sour taste in the mouth that, you know, Yasir had been given out to one that was clearing middle stump by about a metre and hit him outside the line.
Sure thing. It was proof for the technology, for all the grief at Cops, has a very important place in our modern game.
Yeah, because it meant that the genuine result was arrived at. Pakistan weren't robbed. There wasn't a We Was Robbed campaign.
Absolutely
And Australia got the win and actually deserved it.
Yeah, so Steve Smith said he was feeling quite anxious when they had 60 to get. That's when Nathan Lyon nearly took a screamer with his arms, you know, at full stretch like a soccer goalkeeper. And Jackson Bird didn't quite get fingertips on the ball coming back at him, which would have run out Yasir at the non-striker's end. So all this stuff was going against Steve Smith until Mitchell Starc from around the wicket bowled an absolute snorter at Asad Shafiq that came spearing at his throat, and finally the ball shouldered into the gully and the match was all but over.
Yeah, David Warner, a couple of hands out, managed to claim it. And, you know, then there was that weird run out of Yasir Shah just to finish it off. So he's like, all right, we've got 40 to get right to the other end. It's all on me. I've got to do the scoring. Has a big sort of swipe at one, doesn't get it cleanly. And he was so annoyed at having not got runs off a ball on his pads that he was just sort of looked at his batting partner and didn't realise he was 2 metres out of his ground. And Steve Smith at slip throws down the stumps.
I loved the response to the crowd by that stage. We were down there with them to Yasir walking off when they were just chanting, "We are so proud of you. We are so proud of you." It was spine tingling stuff.
What
a response to it, though. I mean, they've lost the game of cricket.
Yep.
And you know that should be where the supporters are most desolate. But they that was when they expressed the most pride. I think that was just like they felt something.
Yeah.
They knew something special had occurred.
And I know, you know, maybe some listeners might think that we're going over the top in pumping up Pakistan so much, but the point that I would make that's really stood out to me is that Mohammad Amir made his best test score. Asad Shafiq made his best test score. Yasir Shah made his best test score. Wahab Riaz made his second best score. So those four all overperformed so dramatically given their careers to date. They all brought the absolute best that they had. And in doing so, they very nearly did something that hasn't been done in 140 years of Test cricket. You know, to chase down a score of that magnitude would have been an absolutely astonishing feat. And to get within 40 runs of 490 is as astonishing.
Yeah, it was nearly the most significant Test victory of all time, or the most substantial one, but it was still pretty amazing. And it's really made the summer in terms of what we have coming up in Melbourne and in Sydney.
Excitement now. I mean, how much more attention and energy is there around this going into Melbourne?
Absolutely. I mean, for Steve Smith, it was relief for the most part. Misbah, he said himself, to rhyme again, drew belief from the performance, saying that he thinks they can now win in Melbourne and win in Sydney. He didn't feel like that was the case after.
They've got
first
a bunch
innings.
Of batsmen who've made runs now, you know, we've seen the pitch in Melbourne for that one-day game the other week against New Zealand. That would suit Pakistan down to the ground.
You it think was so slower,
slow-paced, a bit low, a bit sticky.
It was slow last year too. You might recall.
Yeah.
Or it was certainly slow on day one. It held up a little
stodgy.
Bit. So, yeah, stodgy, that's right. So they picked the same squad for Melbourne, which I think is interesting. So Maddison's retained his spot. We won't go on about this, but
as we said, I think. You've got to give the boy another run.
And they have also noted that Mitchell Marsh may be brought back into the side, or an all-rounder who bowls fast. So Steve Smith, Darren Lehman, effectively saying that if they want an all-rounder, they'll be going to Mitchell Marsh. If they feel like any of the bowlers don't come up after a pretty hefty workload in the second dig.
Okay.
As for Pakistan, I mean, as you say, I think they are now cherry ripe for another good performance in Melbourne after what they finished off with here. And as I said, I think this really does bring a whole other dimension to the summer. Had Australia rolled through Pakistan in 3 days, we'd be saying similar to what we did against the West Indies last year. Like, there's a degree of inevitability about Boxing Day, whereas you know, they'll just about pack out the MCG on Boxing Day now. Maybe not the full 100,000, but they'll go, you know, 3/4 of the way there.
This is The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins, ABC Grandstand.
Welcome back. This is The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. We've got Brittany Carter with us here to talk Women's Big Bash League again. Hello, Brittany. How are you?
Hi, guys. Well, thank you.
Good. So this weekend we had games across 4 different venues, Saturday, Sunday games, as it were. Well, actually, one was a Friday, Saturday, but they were thwarted due to rain. We'll come to that. But we started off in Bendigo, and I thought that was probably the pick of the litter in terms of the round, with the Hurricanes doing the double over the Renegades, Jeff, and it was a very Hobart way to win two matches, wasn't it?
Yeah, only just doing the double. Last ball wins in both games. The second one was a super over, which we haven't seen a lot of in the women's comp. So
I think it was one last year in the last round, wasn't it? It was the Adelaide Oval number 2 between the Strikers and the Renegades.
But
neither could make
just
the finals
the
anyway. Yeah, that's right.
I think that was just the one. And the Renegades have got this habit of dropping close matches, so they're right down the bottom of the table again with the Sixers down the bottom with one win apiece, and the Hurricanes up equal top with 6 points. 6 points. They've got the 6 points. It's all about getting the 6 points and looking forward to next week. But yeah, to win it in the Super Over, especially when they lost a wicket from the first ball of it and then came back. Erin Burns isn't sort of one of the big star names, but she's a player I've been a bit of a rap for. And she just creamed a couple of deliveries and easily chased the 12 runs that were required from that Super Over.
Yeah, they kind of choked too, didn't they, when you think about the context of that chase. They were 2 wickets down and they were flying when they lost a couple at a crucial moment with like 4 or 5 overs to go. Probably not even that. I think when they lost their third wicket, there might have been like 15 balls to go and they needed 15 runs to win. And it was a real capitulation. And there's 2 runouts in the final 2 balls. Both the Mollies were run out.
Yeah, 2 Mollies run out. And they managed to get 1 run amongst those 2 runouts. The second one, they needed 2 to win. They had to come back for the second. There was no choice in it. So they got the first to tie it and then run out coming back for the second. So at least, you know, the throw wasn't mucked up because there's pressure on the fielder at that point as well. But, you know, the first match as well, supremely close, with the Hurricanes managing to get over the line again.
But it came all the way down to the last ball. So Chris Britt made runs for the Renegades on both days, 51 not out on Saturday and put on 70 with Danny White. Who was fortunate, but nevertheless, she still prevailed. They put on 70, and they were the two who were leading the charge there. So I guess they've got options, the Renegades, just they can't close games out.
Yeah, and it's like, how long does that go on until, you know, it starts to become something that's endemic in the squad? You know, do they have the confidence to do it? They didn't get a lot out of Grace Harris on either of those days with the bat, where she'd really be the one expected to, especially coming out in the Super Over, tailor-made for Grace Harris, really. But she wasn't able to get any balls away, particularly in that over, was, you know, got a couple of singles and a dozen from it was, I mean, it was an okay total, but it just didn't feel like enough.
And we buried the lead a bit here, Brittany, haven't we? Because Amy Satterthwaite was brilliant for the Hurricanes, player of the match on both occasions, making 45 not out on Saturday and then 52 not out off 41 balls on the Sunday. So she continues to be one of the most important players in world cricket.
Yeah, I think she's one of the key talking points in these games, performing in both of those. But something that was really interesting for me was the Hurricanes seemed to be able to face spin, and I think that was really a downfall for Melbourne. I mean, Molly Strano was only able to take 1 wicket in 2 games. Molyneux couldn't take any. Harris took 1 in each game, so there's something to be said there. But funny enough, when it was turned around, the Renegades couldn't face Hayley Matthews' spin, so she took 4 wickets. And it was just funny to see that happen, considering last year that was such a big thing in their motto.
Yeah, the other thing the Hurricanes have added this season is Veronica Pike is making runs, which wasn't really a factor last year. I think she was second on the wicket-taking list last year. Good sort of death bowler, pretty tall. But she's started to be a bit of a pinch hitter, made 27 off 15 balls in that first game and made a few runs earlier in the round as well. So if she can keep slogging away, that's another weapon for them.
I think that's really important for her too, because she's 35 years old now. She's a veteran in the Tasmanian side, but to establish herself as an all-rounder as she sort of nears the end of what would be considered in-form age for a cricketer, I think that's important to keep her spot in the side.
So it was the Hurricanes with 2 wins over the Renegades. Let's go west to Western Sydney, Penrith, the Rith. Got rained there, didn't it, the first time? They tried to play 2 games there over the weekend. The Strikers and were visiting for that Friday, Saturday it was for those two. And they didn't get a ball in on the first game. So they were on the second occasion, the Thunder were pretty
miserable, weren't they?
Well, they have been so far. Yeah. With the exception of that game where they knocked off the Stars in Albury on Monday, they conceded a ton of runs to the Stars at North Sydney on TV last Saturday night. And they have been disappointing. I mean, considering where
nearly
they
nearly chased them, though. I mean, they very nearly pulled that off. Harmon Preet nearly pulled that out of the bag.
Fair enough. But, I mean, still, this is the second occasion now where they've been beaten comfortably. So the Thunder made only 102 in their 20 overs. They lost the toss. Stefani Taylor and Rachel Haynes were both out early. Sophie Devine had Taylor move caught behind, showing her sort of dual threat value. And really, they didn't recover. Alex Blackwell stabilised things at number 3 and made 28. And it was important after Harmon Preet, who you mentioned before, she was out for nothing. She was bowled by Talia McGrath. So Stallenberg and Farrell made some runs towards the bottom of the list, and they, after getting together at 5 for 53, and they got them up to some sort of respectability. But Adelaide did it easy. And as usual, it's Sophie Devine.
Yeah,
33 off 33 balls.
Got the key wicket too. Got Taylor out with the ball, and then came in and made yet another 40-odd. She seems to specialise in 40-odds.
That's her third score between 41 and 43. I think she's gone 43, 41, 43.
Wow. All right, let's see if we can keep that up for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
You know, maybe could go over 50 one day. Wouldn't hurt. But she makes them quickly, and that's key. Like, you know, there are a few players in this comp who struggle to really get away, and she's never one of them.
The only other major talking point from this game is that Belinda Vacavera took what I think is, there won't be a better catch this tournament, sprinting in from mid-off and diving at full stretch, the whole way forward, and just getting the ball in the end of her fingers, and to remove Tammy Beaumont for five as well, who's England's dominant opening batsman. So pretty good effort there. Brittany, you've watched the Thunder very closely. What's going on in Western Sydney?
I think the Thunder are more comfortable bowling first. There's tight bowlers and fielders, and I mean, Blackwell makes a big factor. I know she did better against the strikers, but when she performs better, she seems to lift up everyone else as the captain. But seeing Belinda Vakarua come in and replace Lauren Cheadle, I think, has been better for them, even though they haven't got the results at the end of the day. Lauren Cheadle was none for 24 in two overs in the first game, and Vakarua was one for eight in that game against the Melbourne Stars in the only game that they've won. So I think she's been key changing that up for them, but otherwise I'm not really sure what to say. It's sort of just been a bit disappointing.
Yeah, I think in the case of Cheadle and Vacarera, I always struggle to pronounce her name. They've both got long futures ahead of them. They're both playing in the Shooting Stars squad. And in the case of Cheadle, she's made her international debut and performed very nicely at T20 level for the Southern Stars. So they've got a very talented young list. Let's keep going further west, Jeffrey.
All the way west.
All the way west.
Wild.
The Wacker, where the Heat were visiting the Perth Scorchers. They took one rubber apiece in the first one. On the Saturday afternoon, the Heat were kept to 101 for 9, and the Scorchers made it two down and did it with a leg in the air.
Well, I mean, almost sort of inversions of the same game here, you know, where the side batting first is restricted heavily, doesn't get bowled out, but limps to a pretty unimpressive total, 9 wickets down, and then the side batting second chases it 2 wickets down.
Yeah, I liked that all bowlers for the Scorchers bowled 4 overs, and they all took wickets. It was very neat on the scorecard.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. Bit of symmetry.
Yes, and they finished...
What a mortal hand or eye.
And it was equally as clinical with the bat as well. They did it with only losing 2 wickets. Nicole Bolton, the Australian opener, 46 not out. She'll be happy with that to get an early score in the tournament on the board. And
yeah,
Heather
struggled
Graham,
a bit last year, really, to make her presence felt. So she's, you know, got a bit of ground to make up.
And Heather Graham made 29 not out as well, and Bolton won it with a reverse sweep. So just to keep things interesting all the way through to the end. And then we've got the reverse fixture, or the Heat turned them over.
Hilarious one where they have 4 stumpings in the Scorchers innings.
And it was your favourite, Beth Mooney, Jeff.
Yeah, Beth Mooney just kept whipping off the bales, and also made a truckload of runs when, you know, she batted and basically chased that score down on her own. 67 not out from 46 balls, specialised in just making half century after half century last year. So good to see her back in the runs.
Yeah, it was the individual performance of the round, because Perth were actually going pretty well at 1 for 27 in the fifth over, but she took the bales off when Villani and got her out for 19. It was a very tidy little stumping from the medium pace, I think, of Kimmins, so not a bad effort at all. And then they lost 9 for 67, including those 4 stumpings. And basically those stumpings included pretty much the entirety of the middle order, so to pace and spin. So Mooney was clutch there, and as you say, went out and made that 67 in no time at all. So they didn't anyone else. They did it 2 down. They did it easy. So I think that Beth Mooney is showing that she's really a player on the improve. She made a ton for the Queensland side in the WNCL, Brittany, and she's the sort of player who Australia in the longer term will see as batting at the top of the list, whether that's with the gloves or otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. Something that's key when I look at the Brisbane Heat, though, in terms of the start to their competition, their batting's really letting them down. Like, I know Mooney did well in that last game and Dodden saved them in the first, but for the rest of the team, I don't think they're doing that well with the bat. And when you look at their bowling, I mean, Holly Firling, who's supposed to be an opening Southern Stars bowler, she's only taken 1 wicket in 3 games. So Sreedan Madana, who hasn't really lived up to the hype of all the Indian inclusion in this one that Kaur has, she's only made, I think, you know, 3 totals less than 10. It's really 2 players that seem to have saved them their 2 wins so far.
Yeah, and why is DeAndre Dotton coming in at 5, Jeff? That seems odd to me, that you would have your most dynamic player. And having lost Grace Harris to the Renegades in the off-season, they need to really have a like-for-like there. I think it's odd that she's coming in down the list.
Yeah, I suppose the rationale is that she's the kind who can come in at the end and really ice it after maybe your more sort of stable players through the middle order, Jess Jonathan and those types can provide more of the core of an innings, but especially when they're struggling, yeah, maybe the call is to get her through at an earlier spot.
So both the Heat and the Scorchers are sitting at 2-2, right in the middle of the table, WBBL, after four games played. And finish off, we've gone west, then west again. Let's go to southeast Melbourne and Cranbourne East, to be precise, Jeff, where the Stars had a fantastic weekend against the Sydney Sixers, who are in all sorts.
Cranbourne, where they invented cranberries. Lovely part of the world down there.
It's where I'm from, so let's be nice about it.
That surprise suburb, you know, when you're on the drive to Phillip Island and you think you're out of Melbourne and then suddenly Cranbourne just comes out of nowhere and you're back in the suburbs. Thought you're on the highway. It's not happening. No. Look, the Sixers, well, a bit like last year. Rubbish start. You know, last year they didn't win a game in their first six. This year, at least they've got one win on the board, but that's the only one they've got. And they've looked quite ordinary, really. I mean, Meg Lanning did them on her own in that first match, and it was pretty easy for her. 66 not out from 48 balls, chasing 122. And, you know, then when it came to the second one, they just couldn't put a decent total together. 111 was all they managed off their 20 overs. So pretty underwhelming round all up with the bat.
Yeah, and certainly up the top as well, there was a commonality between the two performances. Mm-hmm. Early wickets, Perry and Healy and Van der Kerk, who made two ducks, the South African captain, in those two games. So they were 3-for-5 on the first game, and it wasn't much better in the second.
Perry and Healy were dismissed pretty much the same way in both of those games.
Oh, did you see that YouTube of Perry getting dismissed identically?
And Inglis, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the dismissal for Perry, down to the appeal, down to the celebration, it was quite extraordinary.
Exactly the same. And Alyssa Healy was bowled by Hazel both of the times too. So
Yeah, that's right. So Danny Hazel from England, the England spinner who's filling in at the moment as a player. Kristen Beams.
Kristen's really going to have to fight to get back in that side. She's doing very well.
I think she only gets to play for... I think they've only signed her until Beams comes back. I think they've done one of those deals.
Yeah, one of those injury replacement. The technical committee has approved the change to the squad.
It's sort of unlikely when she will come back, though.
Mm. So the Sixers made 122 for 8 in the first game and 111 for 8 in the second. On both occasions, the Stars did it easy with 3 wickets down in the first game.
Exciting for me. Jess Cameron made runs into that. I've been pretty pumped about her comeback after she had a bit of a break. So 45 not, and the Secret Life of Katie Mack, 48 not out. She chipped in quite a few times this season too after a pretty miserable one last year. So, you know, maybe the Stars have got that support for Lanning. She can't do it every single time, and she didn't in that second game, was out for 9, and normally last year that would have meant they were done, but now they've got a bit more in reserve.
And the Sixers, Brittany, will be encouraged by Ash Gardner, who made 38 in the first fixture, an unbeaten 43 in the second, using her feet really well on both days, getting down the track and hitting down the ground particularly well. That means that they were able to, you know, at least show some backbone when they lost their top three.
Yeah, the Sixers seem to, as you said, just be having the same sort of start as they did last year. To come back to the Stars, and you talked about Jess Cameron and some of the other people that are performing in the batting order when Meg Lanning isn't, I think that really is key, as you said, Jeff, and I know that seems obvious. Your top four, you need to be the strongest and spend a good time getting their iron at the crease, but it's something that let them down last year, and at the moment they've only faced two teams, Sydney, teams two, so... It's hard to say, but if you go off the WNCL form leading into this and how many players make up those two sides from the New South Wales side, then they look to be doing really well early.
They are last, the Sixers, on 2 points alongside the Renegades with one win from their four games. At the top end of the ladder, the Stars are top of the Pops, 3 wins and 1 loss. The Hurricanes, likewise. And then we get into a stream of teams that have won two games, including the Strikers, the Heat, and the Scorchers, before we have the Thunder and the Renegades and the Sixers rounding it out. So we're four games in this weekend on Boxing Day on the 27th at AB Field. It's the Heat and the Stars. They play twice over 2 days at Glenelg in South Australia. The Strikers host the Hurricanes on two occasions, and at Blacktown for one game, Showgrounds for the others. It's the Renegades and the Thunder. On the 28th, we have the Thunder hosting the Sixers at the Showgrounds in their Sydney Smash. And on the 29th, there's two further games. The Sixers and the Hurricanes at Hurstville, also in Western Sydney, and the Renegades and the Scorchers at Melbourne's Dockland Stadium on television. So make sure you get yourself down to those games and continue supporting what's been a fantastic WBBL so far.
This is The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins, ABC Grandstand.
Final word, Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon. Jeff, the Big Bash League is back tonight, starting off with the Thunder and the Sixers in that traditional season opener. It's turned into...
I love that you can call it a traditional season opener as well. Oh, yes. The lime green versus the hot pink.
But
it was when I was a boy.
But in a way, that's what they want, right? They like the idea that people are now getting used to this competition being part of the rhythm of summer. Certainly was last year, getting 80,000 to the MCG for one of those Melbourne derbies or derbies, whatever is your preference.
The derby, there. Adam. We have a bit of class in this booth.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Derby it is. It's Derby in West Australia, isn't it? So I should be aware of that. Either way, the guts of it is that it starts again, and we know there's going to be an influx of interest. We know that it's going to be on TV every night. We know that it's going to start to dominate the discussion around cricket for the next 6 weeks. Mm-hmm.
And we know that it has a substantial influence on the international cricket summer and vice versa. There's no first-class cricket. People can't get into the test team. There'll also be this weird thing with the one-dayers being played through the middle of the Big Bash, meaning that like teams will have some of their best players stolen, and that it sort of warps the Big Bash competition as well. So, you know, which one should be taking primacy?
I quite like, in a way, I mean, it's not ideal that they don't have a window the way that IPL does in India, where there's no international cricket. So that does count against, well, not no international cricket, but limited international cricket, where you, because it runs against the Australian domestic summer. It does mean that teams that have squad depth a better place. So I guess the classic contrast is the Melbourne Stars versus the Sydney Sixers. The Sydney Sixers on paper are a phenomenal side, but they lose the bulk of their international players to duty in two formats of the game for Australia, whereas the Stars have got these replacement players who seem to be just outside the Australian team alongside a couple of internationals who aren't currently playing for England. And before you know it, you've got yourself a far more competitive side, which on paper probably shouldn't be if it was the best 11 versus the best 11. So,
although then you get punished for performing well, as in last year, John Hastings and Scott Boland got yanked out of the Melbourne Stars side because they were bowling so well at the death. Suddenly they're in the one-day squad. Nice for them because they were playing international cricket, but it really limited the Stars as they tried to win a title.
I like that you get a full day's cricket now. I think that the best thing for me is that if you're a kid growing up, you can watch the test match day and then parlay that straight into watching a T20 game or even a couple of T20 games, some of those doubleheaders on the weekend. It's a, you know, imagine what a delight that would have been as a young boy in front of the television.
Just gorging yourself on hours and hours and hours of the stuff. Yeah, I mean, it seems kind of crazy at this stage, but, you know, it's an indulgence that we all enjoy over the festive season.
And it's big business too. I mean, there's a salary cap of $1.4 million. There's $450,000 by the side that wins it, $260,000 for the runner-up. There's 32 group games being played between the 20th of December and the 21st of January, then a couple of semis and the grand final on the 28th of January. We've seen Brad Hogg move clubs this year from the Perth Scorchers, where he's won titles, to the Melbourne Renegades at age 45. That's probably the most significant move of the summer, because Hogg's career at T20 level just seems to go on and on.
Yeah, and bizarre that someone of such advanced years is getting that level of attention, you know, that he is maybe the most significant domestic move, I suppose. Stuart Broad, I reckon, the most interesting sort of from outside, the most interesting new international getting involved.
Yeah, I love that, especially that he is trying to get his way back into the England white ball teams, and he's using the BBL to use that as a platform. Like, he's freely admitting that he wants to play in the ICC Champions Trophy, which is being played in the UK.
Because he doesn't play enough cricket.
Well, it's because he feels like white ball cricket is limited. He does not play a lot of it anymore. He's in the test side, and then he's playing for his county, and there's not a lot of white ball stuff to give him the chance to prove himself, and this is a great opportunity for him.
Isn't it lovely that he's going to make a section of Australian fans have to cheer for him? Because he'll be in their side. He gets at least 1/8 of the Australian.
I think it's
Hobart, it's the smallest city. It's probably got the smallest fan base.
I think I was vaguely a Hurricanes fan before this started, at least broadly. Now I am very much a Hurricanes fan. I'm a Stuart Broad apologist way back.
Can you imagine, like, you know, a Belrive Oval, you know, full as a boot, if you will, down at Boot Park, singing "He's big, he's bad, he's better than his dad," Stuart Broad.
And hopefully sculling out of a boot afterwards and keeping with their Queensland friends we spoke about earlier in the podcast today. Let's just go through the teams real quick. We won't dwell on this because we know this has been a rather long recording today. The Strikers have made the semi-finals routinely. They seldom miss out. They've retained Brad Hodge as captain. Like Hogg, he's about 100 years old. He's also the skipper. Kyron Pollard is back after a knee injury last year, so they're bolstered there. Chris Jordan's here for now, but he might miss out due to England one-day international. So there's this thing as well, isn't there? With England playing ODIs against India, it might mean that some of the internationals from out there may not last the whole journey.
And Joe Warden is gone from the Strikers. He had a couple of pretty good knocks last year. Adil Rashid is probably a bigger out for them, though. He was so good last season.
Yeah, the most prolific spinner in the comp.
Yeah, you know, and really dominated, really just, it was incredibly hard to get him away.
I'll be interested to see whether Jake Lehman can gazump, well, can effectively replace Travis Head, because Travis Head will be playing in the one-day side.
Yeah, true. He'll be gone.
So Lehman will have a chance to start, because he was batting number six in that strikers lineup, you know, famously batted once for 1-6. His first innings was a six, you know, 3 weeks into the comp last year, because the strikers were so convincing with the bat. So whether Lehman can step up on national television and really, you know, force his claim for a national call-up. And then we've got down to Brisbane, or rather over to Brisbane from Adelaide for the Brisbane Heat. Mm-hmm. They were sixth last year. They struggled. But what they've got in their favour is not many Australian players. So they've recruited Brendan McCullum to be their skipper.
He's had his back surgery too, so he's apparently in much better shape than he was towards the end of his international career.
Right, well, that's encouraging for them, because he's certainly a match winner, as is Chris Lynn. We get Lynn Sanity back, which we're all looking forward to on the Twitterverse. He's probably someone who's missed out on taking his chances for Australia, both through form and injury. When he's had a couple of them, he's just coming back through the ranks at the moment, so that's quite helpful. He was the best player in WBBL 05 and recognised accordingly. So those two are legitimate match winners. And also Joe Burns. Now, Joe Burns won't be playing for Australia, but he's probably a cut above state cricket still, so he should be an influence in this tournament.
He should be able to dominate, but T20 isn't necessarily his format. You know, he played a couple of games last year and wasn't particularly convincing. And Manus Labuschagne, the South African, he sort of changed the pronunciation of his own name to make it easier for Australians, so he tells people his name is Labuschagne.
Yeah, not
because it's just too hard.
Labuschagne is a bit too nuanced.
Yeah, I mean, is that now his name? I mean, has he decided he pronounces it that way? I don't know.
Speaking of pronunciations, Badray, or Badry as he's routinely called, he's also back.
Badry's a champion.
He is a champion. He played in the World T20 side for the West Indies at age 35, and I think he's the sort of player who can play a role in being top of the spin list for
them. Took a great five for last year, where he got, I think, the first five wickets to fall, and they were all within, you know, a couple of overs. Just absolutely ridiculous bowler in that he's very, very difficult to get away, and just bowls this sort of sneaky leg spin sliding onto the pads, but nobody can hit him.
Let's keep moving through. Hurricanes down in Tasmania. We mentioned Stuart Broad's in. DJ Sammy's finished up playing for them this year. He's not going to be around. We're not going to heaven with DJ Sammy anymore.
Damn.
There's about four people in the world that'll get that joke. If you did, good on you. Joe Menny's off to the Sixers. Stark and Hazelwood need a bit of cover, so that's why Joe Menny's gone over there. We'll enjoy watching him bowl for Sydney, but he won't be playing for Hobart. I guess the narrative here is that Broad has a foot injury, which he's still coming back from, so whether he can properly play, that's yet to be seen. And Sangakkara struggled last year.
He was awful.
So whether he can, you know, be credible. And then George Bailey, who really needs to continue to make runs to press for a claim if he is to go to India. I know it's a bit out there that he could convert T20 form into a test match touring spot, but we've seen stranger things.
Yeah, but he's going to be yanked out to go into the one-day side January 10 or 13 or whatever it is that they start the one-day series. So he'll be gone. Dan Christian will be, you know, needing to step up in his place, I suppose.
That massive six last year, putting on the roof of the Gabba.
Yeah, Ben Dunk is out. He's over to Adelaide. Every time I see B Dunk on the scorecard, my brain turns it into B Drunk. I'm like, are you trying to tell me something, scorecard? And that's maybe why I have a problem. But, so he's out. And, you know, he could be pretty damaging on his day as well. But they've got Sean Tate, the Tater.
Oh, yeah.
The potato.
Who found a way back into the international squad against all expectations last year, played one game, got hit for $1 million. But he'll be back with the Kane train as well. Let's go down to Melbourne, the Renegades. They don't have any major international players to speak of after losing Chris Gayle, but they do have Sunil Narine, who I shouldn't underestimate, actually. He's a significant recruit, the mystery spinner.
Significant force, and, you know, probably less likely to be an objectionable human than Chris Gayle.
Yes,
maybe.
I think he is a less objectionable human than Chris Gayle, on the basis that you can almost be not as objectionable.
Yeah,
it's a binary thing.
I think Marcus Harris is a good signing as well. He's a bit under the radar. You know, he's not particularly someone who there's, you know, huge raps on or in or around. I don't know what the raps are supposed to do.
He's having a very good Shield season after making the move from Western Australia, so he's certainly locked down his spot at the top of the Victorian list. And then also Brad Hogg, we mentioned before, who's weirdly coming to Melbourne after several years playing for the Scorchers at age 45. Like, he started his first-class career a quarter of a century ago. This is an extraordinary tale.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, maybe ridiculous might be the bowling lineup. Siddle, Pattinson, a couple of pretty handy names if they can get their comebacks from injury right.
And Tremaine, Chris Tremaine, who'll round them out. There's a lot of talk around how well he's bowling at the moment for Victoria. And again, he's another player who's had some Australian experience going on that South African limited overs tour back in October, and he'll fancy his chances of seeing Australian representation again if he can perform well here.
Crosstown at the Stars. They lost the final last year. Kevin Peterson will be back. He wants to go one better. Luke Wright as well, the English batting contingent over at the MCG.
No, not a single change to their squad that made the final and lost to the Thunder at the MCG last year, which I find quite remarkable in the modern game, how you can go summer to summer and retain a squad of 18, not a single move. That's extraordinary.
Petey Hanscom, he'll be missing for the test matches, but do you reckon he's a shout to work his way into the one-day team as well?
Well, you have to be. Well, they were talking him up for the one-day squad before. They were really talking him up for test selection last year. So he'd be some...
And he was in the squad in England. He was one of those emergencies that was drafted in 2015.
Yeah, that's not a bad shout, actually. He was so important last year. But they're also going to lose, we mentioned before, Faulkner, Maxwell, Zampa. I mean, but they're relying on the two English players, Peterson and Wright.
Well, of course, the Australian team needs Maxwell to carry the drinks. So yeah, it's very important to
Marcus Stoinis played a big role last year, as did John Hastings. Is he fit? I mean, Hastings won't be fit, isn't he?
He's getting knee surgery.
Yeah, I think I wrote this note before we had that media release 2 days ago saying that he's out for the rest of the season.
He's definitely gone, yeah.
Scotty Boland, though, he's not in the international squad right now, although he was in Sri Lanka and bowled quite well. Ben Hilfenhaus, the veteran from Tasmania, keeps on keeping on. Dan Worrell, who's now played for Australia at one-day international level. And, of course, Michael Beer.
Former test spinner.
That's right. So they really do well at complimenting the guys who are playing for Australia with those who once have. So maybe a bit of Moneyball action going on there. Now back out west again for our second time today. It's Ian Bell is the big recruit to the Scorchers, replacing Michael Carberry, who of course is ill at the moment, receiving treatment back at home. Other high profile move: Mitchell Johnson is back in Australian cricket for the first time in over 12 months.
Looking forward to seeing whether he can bring himself to actually give a fig about this, or you know,
I reckon he does. He's got heaps of media.
He could, yeah. I mean, it's just one of those things where he could be awful. You know, he could just kind of plop it down the other end and get smacked, or he could be kind of excited to be back after being out of competitive cricket for a while and really fire up and be a weapon.
Heaps of experience. So you add Johnson and Bell to what they already have in Adam Voges, who's out of Australian contention at the moment. You've got Maxie Klinger, who's been such a force at Gloucestershire in this form of the game, and no one in Australia can understand why his Australian cap number is zero. Like, he's still yet to play for Australia in any format.
In any format, yeah.
Then they've got Agar and Bancroft and Whiteman, who are young and close to the Australian setup. They've got AJ Tye and Joel Parris, that both played games last year, although I think Parris is now injured as well. I think I saw something the other day. And Hilton Cartwright, who got picked for the one-day international squad all but, you know, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago. So across the board down at the Furnace, they've got probably the most balanced side, and you think they've got to go in close to favourites.
And then the Sixers, the last side, Sam Billings, they're signing. So English batsman popular this year.
Yeah. Yeah, Michael Lum's retired from formal international cricket, I think. I think he's on that Pakistan Super League or whatever it is now.
Oh,
the one that Graham Swan played in last year.
Yeah, the retiree, the one that Dirk Nowitzki went off to play after commentary duties for ABC.
Yeah, the one that you've heard reports of not being paid for, I think, as well. Other high-profile moves, as we mentioned before, for the Sixers. Joe Meny's into the squad. They'll need him, losing Stark and Hazelwood. And Steve Smith's off the list.
Yeah, they booted him because why have him? I mean, it was like when they were signing Michael Clarke for the Thunder or whatever. Yeah. Like, there's no chance. There's less than zero chance that he'll ever be available for a game.
I really actually think that's a commendable move because I think it demonstrates the maturity of the BBL that you think that it's more important to have an 18th player than it is to retain the Australian captain.
A sort of marquee signing just to put him on the website and say, it's great to have Steve Smith in the Sixers squad. Yeah. You know, yeah, so marketing has sort of taken a back seat now to actual cricket.
I think it really does reflect the maturity of the comp. And they're the hardest hit by Australian representation by a mile. We already mentioned Stark, Hazelwood, Maddinson, who's in the test side, Nathan Lyon and Bird, of course, as well. Steve O'Keefe probably will be by the end of the summer. That'll mean Sean Abbott's got a massive job to do again. He'll be alongside probably Travis Bird later on in the summer when the one days start.
Jackson Bird,
Travis
Head and Jackson Bird have got together. It'd be a hell of a player if you could do both of what those guys could do.
Gosh, a bit loose there from me. Yeah. Moses Henriques is still the skipper. He's got, of course, the experience of Brad Haddin and Dougie Bollinger.
Yeah, if you need people to yell at people, they that's your pair.
Well, they could go back-to-back anyway. So they came last year. And, I mean, if Sam Billings goes to India, and he probably will, they are very light on.
And the Thunder, the crosstown rivals. They've got
champs.
Owen Morgan for a little bit, so that's kind of interesting. So, of course, Shane Robert Watson has injured a calf muscle.
So he's
going to miss the first few games, but Morgan's going to sub in and captain for him, which is handy to have an international captain on your list.
But he's going straight to India after the first few games, so presumably Watto takes over. Usman Khawaja will leave. He made a massive dent in the four games he played last year, so they're going to have to replace him. He made a couple of centuries and a couple of beautiful 50s.
And carried them, into the final.
He was crucial to their title, which they won on the MCG against the Stars. They've got Pat Cummins, who will probably also miss for the one days too. So, this is a common theme amongst the high-profile players. And also Andre Russell, this is a bit of an odd one. So there's a drug cloud hanging over him.
Well, he's missed, three drug tests now in his career,
right.
Which means at that point you're supposed to be suspended. As though you've failed, as in he's, hasn't been available when required to be tested. So that's not a great look.
And he's won six titles in the last 12 months for various different organisations. He's obviously a player who can legitimately win game with bat and ball.
Well, I was sitting in the press box in India when he was absolutely showering us with sixes in that semi-final against India. It was terrifying. I kept ducking. I kept crashing into the glass. But I think his hearing has been set for partway through the season. So until that point, he can play.
Okay.
But it's very dicey.
I think the thing is, especially Michael Hussey not playing in that side anymore, retiring in the last year, they've got a lot of holes relative to what they had in 2015-16. So if they were to go back-to-back, it'd be a mighty effort. I don't see that.
Yeah, I think they're going to crash this year, is my read on it.
Yeah, I hope not, though, because I'd love to see Watto go back-to-back. It'd be great to see, just have another, just something else for Watto.
Well, particularly because he'd be captaining the side where Hussey was sort of in charge last year.
It'd be cute. Either way, it all starts on this evening, provided you hear this podcast on the 20th of December. If you hear it on the 21st, you'll know the result of that first Sydney smash derby, whatever you want to call it.
You could time travel back to the 20th and listen to it on the 20th and then back to the future.
And get the Grey Sports Almanac in 1955 and then give it to Biff Tannen and then change the course of
history.
Yeah, but
if you muck it up, Donald Trump becomes president.
I know, this is the world we live in. I think, Jeff, we have talked about every conceivable angle of Australian cricket over the last 7 days in the last 60 or so minutes. So I'm going to leave it there. It's been an absolute pleasure to bring you the final word, as it always is. We will be back with you next week for another range of cricket items, especially leading into the Boxing Day Test. I think we'll probably do it after the Boxing Day Test.
Yeah, let's do it after the Boxing Day Test. And until that time, eat festively, hug people you like, and be nice to absolutely bloody everybody, because why not? And why not carry that from this part of the season into the year beyond? Merry Christmas to you. We'll see you soon.